the Forged and Unbroken podcast.
All right, hey, we're gonna round the bend again. All right, so, well, thank you for doing this with me. Thank you for sticking in with my IT issues now. 15 years in, you had 10 as a volunteer, started out in Boonesboro, so Western Maryland, and what we were talking about was you're going from like really rural departments, and now you're working in this really cool mix of like a downtown city center, but then also the rural sides of, you know, the outer line areas of the county. So if you could bring us back up to speed with that little bit there.
Yeah. So, I work at the downtown firehouses in Frederick. And, as I said earlier, the county is huge. It's 664 square miles. The city of Frederick is right in the middle, and it's surrounded by small towns and rural stuff in between. So it's not uncommon for us to go on a call where we end up from a downtown firehouse being the rural water supply engine, or being on a call that is, a non-hydrated area, rural water supply kind of stuff. So, and then on top of that, a lot of our stations are, most of our stations are volunteer companies that have career staff in them. I think we have four county stations that are just straight county firehouses, and the rest are volunteer corporations with county staff. And then we cross staff a lot of our units. So it's really interesting. You know, you can go from being on the engine to the rescue to the truck, and you can be downtown, you can be suburban, industrial, and you can be rural, all in the same shift. So you got to be good at everything, and it makes for a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah. And actually, let's dig in on that really quick. When you say you got to be good at everything, I resonate with that just because of the area that I work. Also, we're going from downtown high rises to the rural water. How does that affect you on a daily basis? And what I mean is like preparation. How do you, so many people I've had come to me like, or new officers, like, I don't even know where to begin with how to train my people up. And, you know, we talk it out. I have a couple of things that have worked well for me, but how do you set your day up for not just daily goals, but also like long-term vision? Like, how does your company do that? Because you could get anything and everything, you know, how do you set yourself up for success with that?
I think our department does a really good job at initial training. So our fire academy is one of the longest in the area. It's a little over 6 months long. So we give our people the basics of everything. Nice. So I think that helps. And then as far as in the field, like it's just kind of one thing at a time. You know, you can't cram too much. You can't take one shift and, you know, train on five different things every shift. It's just kind of overwhelming. So I think it works best for us when we just kind of do one thing at a time. And, you know, today we're going to focus on hose lines. Next shift, you know, maybe we got a car at the local junkyard. We can go down. We can start doing, you know, some extrication or stabilization drills on the car. But it's kind of just focus on one thing at a time and just build those basics up. And then, you know, the advanced stuff will kind of come over time as you get better with it.
Yeah. Do you have any type of processes with, we'll say specialty equipment? So not necessarily special ops, but if you have like, I know you have a rescue in your house, or there's, you know, tiller trucks, whatever the case may be, is there more of a selection process, or does it go by seniority, or does it like, hey, anybody can be assigned here? Nothing's handpicked, or there's no extra certifications. We're going to bring you up in training. How does that work for you all?
It's kind of a mix, honestly. So really you can be assigned to any firehouse. But when it comes to the special services, like the truck and the rescue, it's really more company dependent. So I guess it would be the captains, you know, the station captains, they kind of decide what's going to be required for you to ride those specialty units, if anything, or especially what you need to do to get cut loose to drive them or operate them. Now, like the two stations we have that have tiller trucks, you know, you don't have a high likelihood of being assigned there if you don't have a Class A license.
Yeah.
But that has changed. We have changed our staffing model a little bit and added some, you know, we're in the transition period right now between three-person staffing and four. So okay. Some of the firehouses have four-person staffing now. So that has changed the dynamic a little bit. You are more likely to get to one of those spots now. But, yeah, I mean, to answer the question, it's kind of station dependent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very similar to where we're at as well. Now, moving into some of the city stuff that we were talking about, I was joking that, my wife and I spent 5 years in Annapolis. We have our historic Main Street Ellicott City. A lot of people know of because it flooded pretty catastrophically a couple times. Yeah. Now we made national news for that. But Frederick City is a really, really cool city. My wife, having lived here, has seen an enormous amount of change. I think I mentioned before that I know it's, at least for 7 years, it's been like the fastest growing city in the state. And you're doing everything from almost like revolutionary war times, right? You're talking 100-year-old buildings, hundreds of years old, Civil War era, a lot of them, you know, hospitals. There's a lot of Civil War history here as well. But when you're dealing everything from, the sawmill turned grocery store turned mechanic shop turned yoga studio turned coffee shop, and you were saying, you're joking, like, yeah, there are tons of breweries and wineries and distilleries now in the city and the county. How is that affecting your operations? What are you seeing on the front end? What are you finding out on the back end? I know you've had a couple big fires here with those South Street apartments. You had the Record Exchange store, you know, not too long ago. Well, you had a candle factory, right? Not too long ago either. Was it a candle factory? It was one of the stores on the south side, closer by Company 3. It was one of the bigger fires that you've had in the last couple months. I can't remember what it was. But, yeah, you've had a couple big fires here within the last year in these historic structures. So how is that? How does that affect operations? What things do you know about, and what things are you finding on the back end of these things?
A lot of these buildings have been retrofit many times over. A lot of them are now, you know, divided up into different apartments and things like that. And the city does a pretty good job at regulating that. So I'm not saying that there's definitely some, but there's not a whole lot of the illegal division that you see in some of the other larger cities. But these buildings are divided up. They've been remodeled, they've been rehabbed. So you get this weird mix of really historic elements and modern construction kind of mixed together. The one that you were talking about on the south side, that was on Carroll Street. And I was not on that fire. I was off that day, but I happened to be in town and I had my kids with me when the call went out. So we went and we buffed it.
But, yeah.
That was a... Man, my kids love that.
That's awesome.
Anyway, that one in particular it's an antique shop. So it was an old building, but there was a fire in there previously, like a year prior to that, a small fire. And we had done some pre-plan stuff, some walkthroughs. And one of the things is like that was an old mill of some sort, some kind of mill. And there's shafts that go from basement level to four floors up, five floors up. So that's definitely, you know, if we're not getting out in these buildings, like not knowing that that's there is definitely a problem.
Yeah. Is that something that you all frequently do also? Like, do you have a day assigned or is that a daily thing? Is that, you just do it on a call by call basis? How are you getting into these buildings or how often? And how do you manage that?
Yeah, we got two ways that we go about it. My shift in particular, especially on Sundays. So we don't do it every shift. We try to do it a couple of times, you know, a month, but particularly on Sundays, we walk. So
nice.
We'll go out. It's, you know, it's not vigorous activity, but it's just kind of a shift group physical activity. We'll go find a section of our first do and we'll walk it. And during the walk, we're just looking for stuff, right? So taking note of the buildings, all four sides, how would we access certain things? A lot of times we just walk into them. So if the door's open, like we're just going to walk in and just start taking a look, obviously not in like people's homes, but you know, some of the other buildings. And when we find something that's really interesting, or if we find a building that it's being rehabbed and they're putting a bunch of new stuff in it, we'll try to set up appointments and we'll get the city companies together, you know, to do a walkthrough. We do walkthroughs quite frequently.
Yeah, that's awesome. So yeah, both formal and informal processes just to get out there and get eyes on these buildings. Yeah, that's awesome. Let's switch gears a little bit. So I think if we go back to, if anybody needs to hit the pause button, and I've had the unique opportunity to talk to Sarah Laird and also TJ Prewer. So members and family from your all's department, and they're able to talk about, you know, Battalion Chief Josh Laird and the Ball Road incident. And I learned so much, and it was obviously near and dear to me because there were so many similarities to your all's line of duty as well as ours. Before we get into the hasty side of things, how has that affected you and the department? And I said hit the pause button because definitely please dig into those podcasts to learn more about the incident and how it's affected, you know, the Laird family and then also the operations of that call. But there's obviously major operational changes. There's, you know, relationship changes. We'll say like there's mental health stuff that comes out of that.
Yeah.
And I see personally, actually, I'm going to set you up with this. I keep pivoting. Sorry. There's two things that I see. And one is when your department experiences this type of event, there are people that really struggle. And rightfully so. That's not me throwing shade. You know, I struggle in my own ways. But there are the people that usually come out of it on the other side. And those are generally the people that have a strong shift, strong support network personally. They're also the people that really work hard at being tactically sound. Like they still have the discipline to do the things that they need to do at work for this job. And I think that it creates competence, and that confidence will create, well, the competence creates confidence, and that helps get through some of these hard situations. So I'm going to set you up with that. Have you all experienced any of that, or what is your take on that? What's that first initial bit of hardship look like for you and the department coming out of that event?
Yeah. I think every single person that was a part of our department at the time that it happened was affected. Everybody.
For sure.
Not just the guys who were on the call, and not just the guys who were close to Josh. I mean, I know, we're a very fast growing department. Like we went from when I got hired at like 250 people to 600 now in a very short period of time. So there's plenty of people who didn't even know Josh. It still affects them, right? Sure. We're small enough that most of us know each other. And, you know, even if you don't necessarily personally know that guy, it still kind of feels like you did. I did know Josh personally. He was actually the station captain at my rookie assignment. So I didn't work for him directly. His shift relieved my shift when I was a rookie. But you know, I got to see him every morning, and I did work on his shift a few times on trades and stuff. But yeah, man, it definitely affects everybody, and it does affect people differently. I think our department did a pretty good job at trying to support one another, both the department itself, and just the members, like we came together. It's actually, you know, it sucks that it takes something tragic for it to happen, but it's pretty incredible to see how we all kind of came together. And then, you know, on the back end of it, the department took a really big step back and a look within. And, you know, something that I definitely commend the department for is when they did the review, like there was a couple of internal people, but most of it was external people. And the department was ready to sit back and take it on the chin. Yeah. You know, what have we been doing wrong that may have contributed, and how are we going to fix it, instead of, you know, trying to blame something else or sweep it under the rug. So,
yeah, no, I definitely commend your department for that. I learned a lot from the Ball Road at like after action, the internal report. They did a good job, and I commend any department that's going to, yeah, like you said, take one on the chin, like, hey, but we're going to turn over all these stones and see what's up and see what we can learn from it. As I know I've benefited from that, so I can certainly appreciate that. Now, I definitely don't want to put words in your mouth, but my impression is that you took that incident and used that for growth. And I remember you telling a story of you like feverishly writing down stuff on a napkin to plan out how I can create something that might help a firefighter in the future, or how it may have affected this event. So it's been pretty cool to be on the sidelines and watch the evolution of the Hasty Rescue Strap. So if you could walk us through that. Ah, there it is. That's amazing.
Yeah, I keep it. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I just keep it, but I keep it here on the desk.
That's awesome. Yeah,
so I'll back up a little bit before the incident then. So I started, I always knew I wanted to be an instructor. And I was going to wait a little bit farther into my career before I decided to jump into it. But I was actually asked by our lieutenant of training at the time to join. He said, I think you'd be a good instructor. I want you on. So I agreed to do it earlier than what I was initially planning. And I've always liked RIT and Mayday stuff. It's always kind of been high on my interest stuff. And I got lucky enough to be assigned the safety and survival program. So when I became an instructor, there was like four or five of us at the same time who were new coming on and going through the process. And so we all got assigned a different class to teach. And I was lucky enough that they assigned me that one. And I tried to take it and run with it. So I teach that to our recruits. I still lead the program now, and I've made some tremendous changes to it. Not that what we had before wasn't good, but I've taken a lot of classes myself, and I've traveled, and I found stuff from all over that I could add to the program. Yeah. So I actually added time to it. And then on top of that, I assisted with some in-service training. So almost to the day, a month before Ball Road, we had a training, and the division basically put it on me. You know, they said, hey, we want to do this in service drill. We have an old school here. We've only got a couple of days to do the training because they're going to tear it down, but they said we can do whatever we want with it. And we want to have a RIT component. There was a roof cutting component and then a RIT component. They said, just go look at it and tell us what you come up with. So I did that, and I came up with a plan, and I said, this is what I want to do. This is, you know, the materials I need. And actually, to my surprise, the training chief and the lieutenant of training both were like, all right, whatever you need, like, we'll make it happen.
Awesome.
So over the course of 3 days, we ran the vast majority of our department through the drill. And that was pretty cool. Like, that was my first big department-wide drill that, you know, I don't want to say it was mine, but a lot of it was mine, right? And some of the parts of this drill were actually eerily similar to what happened at Ball Road, or at least, you know, some of the stuff that they had to encounter. And if you talk to some of the guys who were involved on the RIT team, like, they'll say the same thing, that they thought back, like, wow, we just fucking did this. Like,
wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so anyway, that happened, and there was a part of me that was like, felt a little bit of a punch in the gut. Like, man, I just ran our entire department through this, and was that training good enough? Did this really prepare them? And it wasn't until I read that report and I saw the stuff from the guys that I finally was at ease with it. But that was something that I definitely thought about for a long time. Was, you know, should I have done something different in this drill?
Yeah.
But on top of that, you know, talking to some of the guys, this is now post-incident, maybe close to a year. After talking with some of the guys who were on the rescue and hearing their stories, and, you know, one of the things that was attempted, two of the things that were attempted was a waste belt conversion, which didn't work for whatever reason, not knocking those guys at all. And then the other one was a DRD deployment, which also did not work. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, like, there's got to be a better way, or there's at least got to be another option. And there was another guy who, he's also living in the Frederick area, and he had a strap that he had developed for strictly for packaging. And I was looking at it, and I was like, I think I can add something, some element to this. I'm just trying to think of it. And I actually stopped thinking about it for a little while. And then I was sitting at a brewery with two other guys on the job. One, another firefighter, is a good friend of mine. And then the other one's actually a battalion chief. And he's actually the guy I was talking about earlier.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
We were just, you know, in the middle of just three guys hanging out, drinking a couple of beers at a brewery. And it just popped in my head, like, I can add these elements to that design and improve on it. And so I flipped the beer coaster over and started drawing some stuff on it. And, you know, from there, I started the development phase, I guess. Started buying some materials and trying to put it together, and borrowed a sewing machine from my grandmother. Like, I didn't even know how to set a sewing machine up, but I figured it out. And, you know, on my kitchen table, I sewed together a couple different concepts and started taking them to work and, you know, trying them out, you know, on duty, and, you know, eventually kind of came up with the design that I got.
That's awesome, man. That's really amazing. This is something that's always intrigued me. We'll get deeper into this. What was, not that it's outside the fire service, but like just this mentality of, hey, I think I've got a really good idea, and so many people can just shelve it, or they're like, the barrier to entry or the amount of work that's involved is too great. I've certainly been in that scenario. I've got a ton of projects going on in my life, and I can, that's like, one of them is kind of like that for me right now. What is that like for you? Like, what was it that kept you going when it's so easy to be like, nah, somebody else is going to do it, or it's too much work, or like just the fact that you had to set up a sewing machine and figure out how to sew to make these straps can be a large barrier to entry. Like, what was the drive? What kept you going?
I wanted to figure it out. So, like I said, I kind of took it a little bit personally.
Yeah.
With the Ball Road incident, even though I was not on the call, I wanted to figure it out. Like, I wanted to find a way that I can contribute to something that my end goal was never to make money off of it.
Yeah.
It's to make enough to continue doing it. But my ultimate goal is do what I can to make the fire service better. I love the job, man. I live it, you know, it's all I want to do. But I want to try to make it better. And this is just my niche. And,
yeah, cool.
You know, not being personally involved in the call, I just felt like this is my contribution. I can take, you know, a tragedy, and, you know, obviously I can't fix the tragedy, but I can, you know, I can do something positive for it. So, yeah.
That's awesome, man. And you're still affecting change, a positive change in some way, you know, you're involved in it secondhand, like you said, through your training. That's really powerful. And as a quick rabbit hole before we get into the technology itself, I'd love to hear, you kind of already mentioned, you know, fatherhood, you know, you've got kids, you know, married with kids. What, going through this event, but then also rising up to meet the challenges of starting something completely from scratch and learning how to figure this out, doing the business side of things, like firefighting schedules and occupation and lifestyle can be challenging enough. How does this job and how has this venture affected fatherhood? Has affected, you know, relationships, positive, negatively? If you don't mind doing a quick dive on that, I'd love to understand.
Absolutely. If you don't mind. I'll start it with this. I'm not the guy to give anyone advice on it because when this started, I was married and I am not anymore.
Okay. All right. Hey, I appreciate the honesty, man.
Yeah. My venture with Hasty really had nothing to do with it. The job probably did have some parts to do with it. Ultimately it just wasn't right. And, you know, it was going to work itself out one way or the other eventually. But it's actually interesting enough that the date of Ball Road was actually my wife at the time's birthday.
Oh, man.
So
that's heavy.
Yeah, that was a tough moment. And, you know, even though we're not together anymore, like in the moment, like she was good with it. Like, you know, she was actually pretty supportive. And so I was assigned to our training academy at the time when that incident happened. I was assigned there for 2 years as an instructor. And it also happened right down the street from our academy. And it was not uncommon where if we were not involved in training and there was an incident that happened semi-locally, like we'd kind of load up and go.
Nice.
But we didn't because the call probably went out about 15 minutes after I had left. And so drive home, I was listening to it, heard everything happen. And basically I got home and I told her, I said, "Hey, I'm sorry, but I have to go back to work. Like, this is what happened. And I'm sorry. I can't be here right now. I have to go." So I went back to the academy and I met up with the academy staff. And then we ended up basically setting up I don't know what you want to call it. All the first alarm units came back to the training academy. And that's, you know, we made them comfortable basically. Yeah. What we did. So,
sure.
That was really my involvement. Well, there was a little bit more, but we can get into that later. Mm-hmm. To get back to your question. As far as like fatherhood, it's actually hasn't affected it in a bad way at all. So, my kids are pretty cool with it. Like my daughter, I actually feel bad. She still wants one of these hoodies. She keeps asking me to make one. My son, he'll come down with me in the evenings. Like I have a routine. I do most of my daytime stuff. And then, you know, this really is just a side gig.
Yeah.
Something I do on the side. And so I'll do this in the evenings, right? After dinner, after everything settled down, I come down here. I'll go through my list of orders and I'll start packing them up and he'll come down and he'll help me. Right. Cool. I'll tell him, you know, go over there to that shelf and, you know, get me this part or give me that part and we'll put them together and we'll package them up. And, I've taken them to trainings with me.
So, awesome.
Yeah. Like they'll, you know, if we're going and doing a training, whether it's with Capital Fire training or just a Hasty thing, I'll take them with me. And sometimes they even, you know, get some reps in themselves. So
that's so cool, man.
Yeah. That's pretty
cool. So what I'm hearing is that it's, even through this, it's created maybe more togetherness, or it's maybe it's taken a different format where you get to spend some more quality time together and he gets to see your passion and you get to have that time together when normally, not saying that you wouldn't, but this has just changed it in such a way there where it creates different meaning now.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously if my kids weren't cool with it, I wouldn't force them to do it, but yeah. You know, they seem to enjoy it. And so it's, you know, it's kind of a common ground, I guess, you know, that's not the same as the typical sports, like they are into sports and stuff like that too. Mm-hmm. But, this is just kind of a thing that we can do together. And like you said, it's sharing my passion with them. So,
yeah.
You know, even if they don't pick it up in the future, you know, hopefully they can at least see that like, it's good to be passionate about something else. And, you know, work for something like, if you got a goal, work towards it.
Dude, so. That's huge. That's huge. And you get to spend time together too. Yeah, that's huge. I really appreciate that, yeah, they get to see you putting in hard work on something that you care deeply about, and how fortunate are they to be able to, you know, see that in their father. I appreciate the, me letting you put you on the spot and a little bit of vulnerability there. So thank you for that.
Okay.
Let's talk about the technology itself, man. So, we can even have this conversation. So I'm going to be very frank with you in that, a lot of times when I teach, if the BA is intact, there's not degradation, the firefighter wore it well, you can use that to your benefit, like grab and go. That's what my experience was. Step two would be some type of conversion if you are intimately familiar with the BA and can do so quickly. And you know, I'll train on just even how to do that quickly. I think people really underestimate some of the skill set you need to do that in a really streamlined and efficient way to create that conversion into a harness. And then step three would be a very simple down and dirty mechanism to get them out, like your strap. I have definitely seen there's a lot of things out there on the market, and some of them are complete and total trash, like just straight up. Like there's too many moving parts. Sometimes there's tons of features. There's color coded. There's many things hanging off of them. Like the more things there are, I think the worse they can get. That's been my opinion and my experience. And I even have numbers and data to show that, like, we can simplify this down. So I appreciate guys like Anderson Rescue and Jim Kenny over at Depth and Overcome, and then yours, because these are down and dirty, straightforward, awesome pieces of machinery webbing that you're using to get firefighters out of. So if you could, let's talk about, like your design process, and like, you're obviously getting tons of sets and reps, and it's been cool to be on the sidelines watching a little bit of your journey through some of the videos of seeing the simplicity, but also the success of, you know, just a firefighter survival tool. So let's hash it out.
Yeah. I'll take you back to one of the first things you said, and I tell everybody this, even when I'm doing demos with my strap, if it's as easy as a grab and go, do it.
Yeah,
keep my strap in your pocket, right? there's nothing wrong with taking the tail of the shoulder strap of the SCBA, tightening it down as much as you can, mm-hmm. and going. Yeah. Whatever is the easiest way to make it happen in the moment is what you need to do.
Yeah.
Mine is designed for something that is a little more complex. All right. So if you find a situation where you need to put a fireman in a harness or like a conversion, that's where this one really comes into play. So one of the big ideas with it is making the conversion easier. So there's a couple different ways that you can do the waist belt conversion, right? But I think one of the most popular is you got to get the guy's leg up over your shoulder. You got to loosen the straps. You got to manipulate it around the leg, and then find it to tighten them down. And obviously, you know, different SCBAs that you wear might operate a little bit differently, but that's the general premise, right? So you're putting your body in a weird position. If the smoke isn't bad and you can see, you now can't really see what you're doing because your face is buried in their crotch. So the whole idea is just to kind of make the packaging a little bit easier, right? One of the things with some of the other packaging devices is like the pickoff strap or some of the other stuff that are designed just for packaging. A lot of times they'll go to the parachute buckle where you loosen and tighten your SCBA. That's where they want you to attach to. And then between the legs, you go to the other one. What I found was a lot of times one of those buckles is hard to find because of the way that firemen tend to lay when they're laying down. Mm-hmm. It's tucked up under the arm, especially if they're laying kind of face down. It's hard to find. So my idea was, if I can make these straps a little bit longer, if I can get a carabiner that's big enough where you can just go around the entire shoulder strap if I come across a downed fireman, even if I can't see very well, I can use landmarks. I can tell just by using my hands where their helmet is, shoulder strap. I grab the shoulder strap with one hand. I put the carabiner around the entire strap with the other. And you can do it right on top of the shoulder. So if you do it somewhere to the on the front or on top of the shoulder, by the time you cinch it down, it's going to drop to the console. And on the other side, when you do it, it's going to drop either to the disconnect or on the MSAs, for example, they have the chest strap. It'll drop to that spot. So it kind of keeps it in position, but you don't have to search for a small attachment point. You can grab a shoulder strap and hook your carabiner right to it.
Okay, cool.
So that was the idea behind that.
And you have not seen them, that's been capturing it, because that was my question. Like, it's not, as soon as you slide down or put you put the load on it, it's not sliding down any further. It's capturing there and it's holding.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
As long as you put it above the console or above that disconnect. Some SCBAs don't have a disconnect for the low pressure line, and it may drop some. It kind of depends on the position of the body and how much you cinch it.
Okay.
And like with anything else, the more practice you get with it, the more you kind of get the feel for it.
Sure.
But once it's attached and they're more or less packaged, it now has those handles that come off of the carabiners. So I like to tuck them under the arms, and that does a couple things. If you kind of sit the fireman up, tuck it up underneath the arms and pull it tight behind the back, that keeps the body in kind of an upright kind of, I don't know how to describe it, like a slouched position. The shoulders are kind of pushed in, makes the body slightly smaller. If you're doing any type of hoist, it keeps them vertical. But the other thing that does is it keeps those carabiners from sliding down any farther if you didn't happen to, you know, put it on the 100% correct spot, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
And then, you know, if you're going to use the handles to drag, it kind of helps keep the cylinder and the top half of the body off the ground a little bit. Lessens a little bit of the friction. So, but where it really comes into play, where I think that this strap really, really shines, is any type of hoist. So you got to go up and out a window or through a hole in the floor or something like that. It's, you've got them packaged and you've got the attachment point for your hoist all in one. You don't have to attach directly to the SCBA, or you don't have to, run a prusik through the shoulder straps of the SCBA to have something to attach to. It's kind of all
there.
And then on top of that, because the handles are the length that they are, and the way you tuck them up underneath the shoulder when you go to hoist, it keeps that hoist rope away from the brim of the helmet. Right?
Okay.
A lot of times if you attach right to the SCBA, you're knocking the helmet off or you're pushing the helmet forward. And I've seen students get choked because their chin strap's on and the helmet pushes forward and it chokes them, or it knocks their face piece loose or whatever. So it kind of keeps it away from the helmet. So, that's really where I think it shines the best.
Yeah. No, watching your journey, I definitely like the addition of those handle straps, because you can see the benefit in those hoisting operations. Like that's definitely a game changer. It's one less thing to have to worry about. It does position them in a good spot. In these high stress, zero vis environments, are you finding that if it's getting to a point where, you know, your strap is the answer to the situation, these firefighters are getting like quick reps in? So I think that's where some of the technology, people have nothing but the best of intentions, but there's so many damn moving parts that under high stress, zero vis conditions, that you can be in a controlled environment all day and it looks great on YouTube, but until you're in a bad spot, or just like I said, even in training, people, you know, your adrenaline's up, take vision away, you know, you're wearing our snow gloves, that's when it's like, oh, this actually wasn't that great. And I know you're getting tons of reps in with Capital and with your stuff. You're seeing the success around multiple departments, totally like different tiers of firefighting experience and different locales. Like you're getting good feedback from all this.
Yeah. One of the things I will say is it's kind of an advanced tool. right? Mm-hmm. If you get one today, you're probably not going to be good with it. So it's like anything else. You got to practice with it. You got to put yourself through the paces before it'll work. Once you get the technique down, it's usually easier than a standard waist belt conversion. Nice. That's what most people, you know, there's some people who they don't like it, and that's fine. If you don't like it, it's not your thing. Ultimately, I want people to have options, and whatever you carry in your gear, I want you to be good with it. That's ultimately it. It doesn't have to be mine, but to go back to your question a little bit, like, I try to put students through it, kind of that same crawl, walk, run, like we talked about earlier. We'll even do it with gloves off. Do it with your hands so you can feel what you're doing. We'll walk through it slow, find the right spots. Okay, cool. Now you know how it goes and how it should look and feel. Mm-hmm. Now we'll add gloves. Maybe we'll, you know, put you in a place where it's a little bit darker, right? Once you get that down, now we'll smoke it up, you know. Obviously, we can't 100% replicate the entire high stress environment that you'll find on a true Mayday incident.
Sure.
But you know, we can do what we can to at least get that muscle memory down. And again, like I said earlier, if there's an easier way to do it, then do it the easier way. But if you find that you need to package or you need to hoist, like, if you've practiced with this, it's probably going to work pretty well.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I appreciate you saying that, because I think that's what people underestimate. Like, they get one rep in, or they just shove it in their pocket and expect to be really great with it on game day. And just like anything else, you got to use it. And the more familiarity you breed with it, the faster it's going to become. And when it's already a simple, like, piece of equipment, like, you have definitely, like, streamlined it. There's not a lot of moving parts, and it's super effective. That's really, yeah, it's going to be nothing but great things. Have you had any recorded, like, rescues, anything with it yet?
No, I haven't. I've got, I think, just under 300 of them out there.
Nice.
That have been sold. So, and I've only had it on the market for just over a year.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So it hasn't been very long, but it's, you know, it's gaining traction. And nobody has come to me that they've made it happen. So
yeah, it's just a matter of time, man. Like, it's amazing. 300 out there over, you know, just every year. That's awesome.
If only one person ever benefits from it, then it's worth it.
Hell yeah. So. Hell yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah. Something I forgot to ask that you mentioned earlier about the DRD. I think I remember you posting something about this at one point. To your knowledge, is there, I think, what, maybe one person who's used it in a near miss or Mayday that you know of? Do you know?
As far as I know, there has not been a successful rescue with the DRD.
Okay.
As far as I know, I don't continue to research it over and over again.
Sure.
If there is one, I'll gladly admit that it has happened. But as far as I know, there's never been a successful deployment and a successful rescue.
Yeah.
I know there's been multiple attempts. Mm-hmm. You can read NIOSH report after NIOSH report where it's been attempted and failed.
Okay.
Most of the time it's just a failure to deploy. Yeah. So, I think that, first of all, let me say this. I think it's a great idea, and I don't think it should be removed from our turnout gear. I think any life-saving option that you have should be available. But the DRD itself needs to be improved on. So
yeah, agreed.
Just by the nature of, you know, everybody's a different size, shape. They wear their packs differently because they wear them how it's comfortable for them. You know, at least 50% of the people I see, their DRD is covered. You can't even get to it.
Yep. Absolutely.
Right? And then when you can get to it, like, can you even feel it? So, excuse me, my turnout gear personally, the ones that I wear, the DRD is so thin that with gloves on, and it's slippery too. Like, you can't feel it.
Yeah.
So if you can't see what you're doing, you're not going to be able to feel it. So that, you know, that's a contributing factor. I know it's been, I'm terrible with statistics if I don't write them down and look at them, but I want to say it's been like an NFPA standard for almost 20 years.
Wow.
And there's not a, or it's been around for 20 and it's NFPA standard for something like that. And there hasn't been a, you know, recorded successful rescue with it. So, I still teach it in our class, but I try to tell our people, don't let this be your number one go-to because it's most likely going to fail. If you do attempt it, don't spend a lot of time on it. If you can't get it on the first shot, go for something else.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that, man. I've had a lot of similar experiences with that as well. I remember the first time I saw it, it was probably 18 years ago when we started using it on our gear. And I think it was a great idea at the time, but I think the way things have evolved, and especially with so many of the other options and with your stuff that we have out there now, it's not necessarily the go-to. So, and if there is anybody out there that's listening to this and they know of a positive deployment, I would love to hear about it, or even negative ones. Like, it'd be cool to just to hear about the stories on that. So,
Same. I will gladly admit that I was wrong. If there's proof that there was a successful rescue, and then I'll commend those who did it.
So. Yeah. Hell yeah. No, we would love to learn about that. I'm with you, man. And then, like you said, I completely agree. It's not about making money, but you want to make it worthwhile so you can continue to do it. And I feel the same way with the things that I'm doing. And I also know that you are, that you've donated to good causes too. I think the Phoenix Sentinels or the Advocates with Celeste and Sarah, which is amazing. So you're putting your money where your mouth is, man, like trying to also create change for other people, because they're out there putting out the good word with stuff as well.
I wanted to do that, you know, somewhere close to the beginning. So when I've made three batches of straps so far, and when that first batch sold out, I made a second batch, and then I had money left over, and that's what I donated.
Hell yeah.
So it, like I said, man, it's never been about me trying to get rich or make a good profit. I want to make enough that I can continue to buy more materials to make more straps, put life-saving stuff out there. And if I can make enough that I can donate to good causes, then I will. I haven't been able to do any other since. I've been grinding, man, trying to pump these out. And I had to take out a small loan to get my last batch off the ground. So I got to pay that off before I can donate. But that is my plan, man. It's as long as I'm making money, I'm going to continue to donate at least a portion of it.
No, that's awesome, man. Well, in roundabout way, I think I read that you also sponsored one of the Key City spots, right? So it's not a donation to a charity, but you provided opportunity, and that's absolutely, you're still putting your money where your mouth is.
I did that last year. I'm going to do it again for this year's conference. Actually, I should probably announce that soon, because I know we're selling out pretty quick. So I need to get one of the spots myself. This year, it's a 2-day hands-on, so the students will get to pick what they want. There's like a list of classes they can take hands-on for day one and a list for day two, and they get to pick. The caveat is I am teaching the RIC class, so one of those is going to be my RIC class. So
yeah, cool.
The winner is going to take, and it's actually a hasty geared class this year. So almost everything we're doing is all with my strap and stuff.
Nice.
But yeah, so I'm going to buy a spot for that. And then depending on when I pick the winner and what's available, you know, I'll let them pick what they want for the day one class, and then they'll be in line for day two.
Great, man. That's awesome. That's huge. And that's, Key City Fire Conference coming up in March of 25 here in beautiful Frederick, Maryland. It's going to be a good time. Where can people find you, like for products, social media, all that kind of stuff?
I am most active on Instagram. It's at Hasty Rescue Strap. And if you want to look into purchasing anything, it's hastyfireproducts.com. The actual company name is Hasty Fire Products. I made the Instagram before I made the company. So, I sell some other things. The strap is definitely the flagship product, but, you know, selling a couple other things, you know, in hopes of funding more strap production. So,
yeah,
Instagram, Facebook, the website. And then I also recently started a podcast, which you were also just recording with me on. So that's Monday Madeology. On my Instagram, so at one point I realized that, like, this whole page is nothing but an advertisement of me trying to sell something. And I didn't want to be that guy who's just only trying to sell you stuff. Mm. And with the written Mayday stuff being kind of my niche, and relatable to my business, I figured I would start Monday posts. So I try to do it every Monday. I make a post, something Mayday or RIT related. And that eventually turned into, I want to make a podcast because I wanted to talk about line of duty deaths and stuff, but I didn't. It's hard to talk about or break down or criticize line of duty deaths when you're not involved in them. And I didn't want to seem like that guy on social media. So I said, I'll do the podcast instead. I'll bring these people on who have actually experienced these things, let them tell their story. That's what I'm doing with that. A couple episodes dropping soon. So that's Monday Madeology on Spotify and YouTube. Actually on YouTube, it's Hasty Rescue Straps page on YouTube. But and then I'm trying to get it on Apple Podcasts as well, but Apple's a whole different beast.
Yeah, it's a whole other animal. Well, that's awesome, man. Yeah, stoked for it. I appreciate it. It's certainly a niche that, you know, we're right in line with each other. Just good dude going good things with, you know, good piece of equipment. So I appreciate you doing this with me and appreciate what you're doing and putting out there. And I'm sure with all the things that we're doing, we're crossing paths in a lot of different ways. So I appreciate your support and
thank you.
Yeah, what you're doing, man. So any last parting words here?
I don't know, man. Just keep getting after it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Just keep doing the right thing, right? Have the discipline to keep doing all the right things that we're supposed to be doing here on the job every day, personally and professionally. Well, I appreciate you, man. We'll catch up again soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you. Cool.